does anybody find out?
What happens if you don't know your question?
When you have your question, and then she yells, quick.
Yeah.
And then you're like...
This relates to the exam.
Closer to the optimal length. Okay?
have a question.
Yep.
With the muscle length in the heart, does it ever get above optimum?
It can.
It can.
The physiologist will tell you. Physiologists will tell you that in humans that doesn't happen, but the anesthesiologist will tell you that in the operating room there are many times when they think that's the case, and in fact, it's a decreased blood volume, they will see an increase in stroke volume. It depends on whether or not you believe the anesthesiologist. I've learned that that's not really the case because growing up and over all these years, when my brother and I get together, it's very clear that he doesn't know what he's talking about. But then he doesn't think I know what I'm talking about. It's all the same.
Could you talk about the relationship between muscle length and actual mass?
Skeletal muscle. And what we did when we did by skeletal muscle is we put that skeletal muscle in an apparatus where we could lengthen, where we could stretch the muscle or shorten the muscle before we contract the muscle. And what we found out was, that when we were in very short lengths, we didn't get a lot of active force development. And as we lengthened it, we found we got more and more force flow, up until a maximum. And then we started getting less and less force flow. And we decided that the reason that that was the case was because the amount of overlap of actin and myosin, in this case, when it was really, really short, actin got in the way of other actin, so you didn't get good binding sites for myosin and actin to line up. And as we pulled those apart, that relationship got better. As we pulled them apart, there seemed to be an optimal alignment. And once we went beyond that optimal alignment, it was too hard for that as many sites to bind. And finally, if we went too far, there was no binding at all. Okay? And so what we noticed about this skeletal muscle is that the skeletal muscle, the length of the muscle when it's resting that's attached at the insertion origin happened to coincide with the optimal length of that alignment. But when we talked about cardiac muscle, there was no attachment. And we found that in the arrangement of those fibers, the normal operating length of those muscles is actually smaller than. Then if we go back to your then that muscle length is normally less than the optimal length for the alignment of actin myosin. And if we increase ventricular tone, we increase the length of the muscle fibers prior to contraction.
As long as it doesn't go beyond that.
And we call that muscle length prior to contraction. Preload, we'll talk about that in the last case.
So
yeah, this shows the relationship between the input. Muscle length, the output muscle force.
Okay.
Here's this is calcium concentration, the input, and the output is muscle force.
Okay. Okay.
resulted in an increase in muscle force. Leo? Or someplace where she was talking about, I don't remember ever using that term in thing, but she said in dealing with the muscle apparatus and the muscle this and that, she came across the word, or she remembered the word afterload. And here we said the word preload. And I don't know if they were at all related because they have the same piece of word called load. And so I said, well, that was very interesting. Maybe we should talk about that.
Let's talk about it.
Here's an experiment. We can find this experiment. Strangely enough, on the next page. So if we look at this picture, tell me what it is that you see. Tell me what's on that table. Tell me what's in that panel. Panel A. First of all, what is this thing?
A muscle.
What is the muscle doing?
Resting.
Resting. All right. Tell me what else you see. There's no load. Okay. What else do you see?
It's being suspended.
It's being suspended. What else do you see?
Pardon?
DL and support. That's the preload. So what do we do with that DL in the next one?
Put it on the muscle.
What happens to the muscle?
Stretch.
Stretch. So what does the pre refer to in preload?
Before
the contraction. So what we've done is put a weight on here and stretched out the muscle. And what's holding the weight right there?
Muscle.
Well, what's holding position of the load? The recoil. In the muscle. So we stretch this out, and the more muscle, the passive recoil of the muscle is pulling up, and now it's balanced preload. So we say then that the preload, this weight that we put on here, has established the alignment of active myosin in that muscle. That make sense? We said that after we put the preload on, the muscle got stretched, and then it stopped. And the thing that stopped it was the recoil in that muscle, the elastic component of that muscle, acting in the opposite direction of the load. And so as a result of that preload, we have established in this muscle the alignment of actin myosin just prior to contraction, because we haven't stimulated it. Okay? So what did we do in this panel?
You touched an afterload.
I touched it. Attached an afterload. All right. I attached another weight. Okay. And is that weight that I attached pulling and stretching the muscle even more?
No.
Why not?
It's supported.
Because it's supported. And then what do I do? What do I do to the muscle in panel C to begin to see the muscle in panel B? I stimulate. Okay. And when I stimulate it, Oh, here, this is under the medial exercise. If that's the setup, and I stimulate that muscle, what do I see? Do I see the muscle shorten right away?
No.
No. What's the first thing that I see? Do I see calcium entering? No. Do I see an action potential? No. Why not? Because I can't see inside there. So what's the first thing that I go stimulate? Zap. And then what do I see?
Nothing.
Why not?
Because the force is being generated.
Because force is being generated. And what's generating the force?
Myosin.
The active myosin interacting. Is the muscle contracting? Yes.
Yes.
Is the muscle shortening?
No.
Does muscle contraction mean shortening?
No.
What does muscle contraction mean?
Myosin.
What does muscle contraction mean?
Do it interact.
Okay. Then what happens?
Once enough force is generated, barely go over the preload and afterload, it will shorten.
Ah, okay. She said, when enough force is generated in this muscle to barely overcome the preload and afterload, then the muscle shortens. How many people agree? You don't agree with what you said.
Yeah.
Second
place.
And why did you think it was just overcoming the force of the afterload? Because the preload is already balanced. The preload is already overcome. So this started to shorten. After the force developed, was equal to or a smidge greater
than afterload.
So, is the preload related in some way to the afterload? Listen to the evolution of this answer now. She says, the preload and the afterload are related in some way, in some loose way, not really. Right. So the preload and the afterload are only related insofar as the words have the word load in them. Otherwise, they're not related at all.
What do you mean by related?
I mean, does preload have anything to do with the afterload?
Well, they're both attached to the muscle.
They're touching.
You put the afterload on first, then it would be preload. Yeah, then it would go on. That's true. Is that if I'm thinking about the mechanism dealing with the muscle and the muscle contraction, does the preload have anything to do with the afterload?
No.
No. Okay.
I would say that it would, in that the preload determines how far the muscle is being stretched in the alignment of the axis. So the heavier or lighter the preload is, it affects the ability of the muscle to
So what she said was, what I heard her say was, that the preload sets the alignment of the axis of the myosin. And so that sets something about the force of contraction. And what I understood her to say, not the words that she used, what I understood her to say was that would affect the ability of the muscle to overcome the afterload. Okay? But it wouldn't do anything to the afterload because the afterload is that weight. Okay? So yes, certainly the preload has something to do with the ability of the muscle to do work or to generate force and how much force. But the afterload is what the muscle is working against. And so the preload really doesn't have anything to do with the afterload. The afterload is something, it's a load that's imposed on the muscle. Now we're going to come and talk about this with respect to the heart in a minute or two. Michelle?
Just stretched.
Yeah, we will. We're going to do that in a minute. There's an optimal preload for that particular muscle, but the preload doesn't always bring the alignment to optimal. So the preload is a stretching of the muscle prior to contraction. It's not a fixed or a variable amount to get to a certain point. It is what it is. Does that make sense? We'll talk about more. The preload for skeletal muscle is all fixed by the insertion and origin. But the preload in the ventricle is the filling. And the end diastolic filling. What does diastolic mean? Resting. Okay. If it's the end diastolic volume in the ventricle, what is that in the point of time? Just about to contract. So it's the end of filling. Okay. So now, let's go back. Yep. Is that how you measure the preload by the end diastolic volume? That's one way to measure it. How else could we measure it? End tension diastolic. So right here, that volume is the preload. And according to our model, what does pre mean? Before. So if it's the preload, it's before the muscle contracts. That's the volume before the muscle contracts. So we just said that's this volume. The trigger volume is the preload. It's before the muscle contracts. What else could I use as a measure of preload in the heart, the ventricle, or in the whole heart? We said that we could say end diastolic volume is the preload because the end diastolic volume sets the length. What else did we say?
Say what you said again.
Compliance of the because the compliance of the muscle will affect the preload.
Before it gets filled.
And it affects the filling. But a certain thing that I might
once
measure,
it's filled, that volume is there after load. Right? Because you've got to overcome that pressure before you start.
What can I measure?
Pressure.
Atrial pressure.
The what?
Atrial.
The atrial pressure. So we could sometimes call right atrial pressure the preload. And you will see in various discussions that right atrial pressure is used as a synonym for preload. And you'll see that end-diastolic volume is used as a synonym for preload. What are you talking about? Yeah, I'm talking about the mean pressure.
It's just the initial state.
But that pressure doesn't
change.
Right.
And in fact, the way the heart operates and the way the plumbing is arranged, the normal mean right atrial pressure is zero. Essentially atmospheric.
Quick question. Going back to the model and the ventricular volume, then going to the ventricular feeling, which is the afterload aspect of what we were talking about earlier, can you just quickly run through that in a couple sentences just to clarify?
Yeah.
Sorry. Or however long it takes.
In Spanish, please.
Yeah. Maybe in French.
Way to go, Leah. Making it too far.
If I understand correctly, what you want is a couple sentence description of this, right?
Or however many sentences you need.
Okay.
Yeah. More of a volume aspect.
You notice you didn't say a quick description of that, because I can talk real fast and then make it real quick.
Yeah. Free. Concise.
Here we have a muscle. If we're talking about the heart, then this probably might represent the ventricle when filling just starts. Okay? And then the ventricle fills, and so we have the preload. That is, the muscle is stretched because of the volume that's in the ventricle. Okay? And then the muscle's going to contract. And we have to decide then what that afterload is. And so if we now look at our muscle, if we look at our picture of our heart muscle. Where is the load that the ventricle has to overcome before the muscle starts to shorten?
VP2.
Is it the arterial pressure? How many people think it's the arterial pressure?
No, I think it's VP2.
Pardon?
I think it's the ventricle pressure too.
It's ventricle pressure.
Yeah.
Well, but what the question was, if this muscle is contracting, what force must it develop to begin shortening?
The
Is just this pressure?
Yes.
Or is it that pressure? Does it have to overcome the diastolic pressure? What is diastolic pressure? That's the resting pressure. So when this muscle starts contracting, does it shorten?
No.
Why not? It shortens maybe just a little bit.
Because the pressure inside is greater than the pressure the muscle is producing.
Because the pressure inside is greater than the pressure the muscle is producing. So where does that pressure come from? If that's the case, where does that pressure generate? Where does it come from?
Atrium.
Comes from the atrium. So now this is very interesting stuff here. We're standing in the ventricle, and the ventricle starts to contract. Okay? And in some magic way now, the pressure in this ventricle is getting very high, but it's not related to this contraction. It's just somehow there. Does that make sense? No, that doesn't make sense. So, if this pressure is increasing in the ventricle, what's causing it to increase?
There's restricted volume.
Isn't it the isovolume?
Yeah, it can only fill.
Oh, she says, isn't it the isovolumetric contraction?
Isn't that what you're describing?
Isn't the pressure being generated in here being generated because the muscle is contracting and the doors are closed? Yeah.
Before the muscle can move, it has to overcome the pressure that is there just because the blood is sitting there, like the pressure that the blood is exerting on the walls of the cardiac muscle. So then when it starts to contract, it'll shorten it as soon as it overcomes that initial pressure. As a result of the shortening, it increases the ventricular pressure, and that's what opens the
case. Doesn't it shorten when the...
I'm with Kelly.
Okay. Now I'll tell you what he said was that this weight, when it starts to contract, the first thing it has to do is overcome this weight. So now if that ventricle is filled, then the volume is pushing out, stretching the muscle. There's recoil in the muscle. And just before that muscle contracts, that passive force is balanced. That's why we call it recoil. And that's why it aligns the active muscle. So now if we contract the muscle, we said that the pressure in this ventricle is going to increase.
Right.
And somebody suggested the reason it's going to increase is because this valve slams shut. The pressure in here is not greater than the pressure there.
Right.
This valve is already closed. So we have this chamber full of an incompressible fluid called water. And the sides are pushing in on that water, so the pressure increases. When do we start seeing shortening then?
Once VP2 is higher than VP3.
The pressure in the ventricle is greater than the pressure in the aorta. Because what happens then?
Then the
valve opens. Movement of the muscle. So what's the afterload?
Aortic.
Say it again, John. The pressure in the aorta is the afterload. Because that's the pressure that has to be overcome in order to open the valve and allow the ventricle to shorten. Now later on in life you're going to see that afterload is a little more technical than that. But for our purposes, that means the pressure that has to, overcome. Open that valve and allow shortening of if the muscle is not shortening, how can it be increasing the pressure? Well, we could use that as an analogy that when it is contracting, it's decreasing the compliance or increasing the recoil. So what you're saying, what we said in the skeletal muscle, when we had the muscle out, we said we're fixing the ends of the muscle. And so there may be movement inside the muscle at the ends of the muscle. There may be movement inside the myofibers. But because they can't produce motion, they're going to produce force. Is this making sense?
Yes.
I still don't understand your question.
Wait a second. No, wait 1 second, because I heard something that I don't hear very often.
Yachts say very loud.
Yes.
That's okay. Sure. I still don't understand your question. How can the muscle contract and generate force without?
You don't understand.
It's generating pressure.
The answer.
Because it can't. Because it can't compress the liquid.
Let's say we go back.
Liquid's incompressible, so it can't get smaller, so we just gotta get more pressure.
But it's trying to do.
It's just making it push in more, it's not actually getting
smaller.
Yeah,
but how is it trying to push in?
Well,
what's happening?
It's attractive.
So,
yeah, but see, that's trying to push.
But they,
yeah, but they can't close.
So it can't close.
So it's actually pulling on itself. No, it's like pulling on its own fiber.
Okay?
Hey, Kelly's question was,
he's really stretching itself.
Developing force across the muscle.
Here you go.
I don't see movement in the back of the myofibers. And in this model, what we said was, if we fix this end of the head, and we allow actin and myosin interact, and we allow these to shorten, that's going to pull on this spring. It's going to pull on this side, we're going to feel tension between this side and this side. So if I now look at the analogous situation where we have this container, and because there's fluid in the container and the fluid is incompressible, we have, in essence, same kind of situation we have here, where there may be movement within the myofiber. The movement within the myofiber causes this spring to stretch. The overall effect across the muscle is going to be an increase in tension. That's one way of increasing the muscle.
How is that transmitted
from
the pressure? Like, I understand that.
Because pressure is a force per unit area. So that force is transmitted. What you're really saying is that the wall of the container is getting stiffer.
Even though the water isn't compressing anymore because
the pushing
in on it harder.
Yeah.
That's
right. Now, there is another explanation,
Chad.
Because I could make the argument that in an isometric situation, this isn't pulling together. So what we have in that situation is we have a myosin head binding to an actin, and a force that's being generated on there is pushing in that direction. So it's like you holding one end of the rope and me holding another end of the rope, and we both pull on the rope, and we can exert more force on the rope and feel more tension, even though there's no movement in the rope. When you get down to some microscopic level, something's got to show some kind of movement. All right? Are we good with all this? So what is this? Let's repeat this preload and afterload stuff because this is kind of important stuff.
Packing it up.
Yeah?
Question, or rather, see if I have this right in my mind. I was trying to think of an analogy that made sense to me with this whole thing.
Okay.
And I was wondering, like, say you have a kiddie pool that, like, it's all saggy and
like the walls aren't straight anymore. It's a saggy kiddie pool.
Yeah.
And so magically, like over a short period of time.
Oh, waiting pool?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Okay, go ahead.
So magically over a short period of time, you then like you morph it into like this steel-sided, like above ground real pool. It's above ground. And so then then the water's like held in more rigidly. So it goes higher, you know, but if it was a closed, I'm sorry, the water level goes higher, you know, because the walls are straight now. But if it had been in a closed system, then there would be more force exerted, like in an obvious sense. Does that, that's what we're talking about, Chris?
You can't get the container any smaller, but you can make it harder.
You have to see your hands to really, yeah. It was good back here.
Is it kind of like the brake systems on your car?
Yeah.
And putting pressure on. Like, the reason why brakes don't have air in it is because all of a sudden it starts compressing, but there's no displacement, there's no compression in the fluid, and so it causes, I mean, there's increased pressure in your foot, and then from the brake hitting
I don't think you're getting very far with that analogy.
If there's fluid, if there's air in the brake line,
then it will be compressible, and that's not
then
good.
Then you are compressing the air, but the force that you're pushing down on the brake is not being transmitted to the fluid as well, because that force is because the air bubble in the compressed brake.
Squishy brakes.
We're talking about an uncompressed brake.
Yeah.
But what she was talking about was if I take an open system,
I understand it.
Wow. Say it anyway.
Yeah, say it anyway.
If I have an open system, what she says is that if I change that flexible wall into a stiff wall, no longer being able to be pushed out by the water. And what she sees is the water will rise up. The level of water will rise up.
Right.
Okay?
In an open system.
In an open system. But if that system is closed and that same thing happens,
pressure.
Then there's going to be pressure in the inside.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. Since it is a closed system, I guess it's coming in that the muscle is actually shorter because of the compression going outward from the fluid and the forces going inward. Sorry.
It's just like stretching the fibers, like the elastic fibers are stretching. Yeah. The overall length is it.
Gotcha. So if we go to, let's look at this picture. Well, let's look at that picture then. And what we see is if we're talking about preload, we're talking about this volume. The volume that the ventricle is just before it contracts. And if we talk about afterload, we're talking about this pressure, because that's the pressure that has to be overcome for the muscle to shorten and get blood. And what we're going to find out is that unless that arterial pressure goes very high, this force of contraction and the velocity of contraction is so fast that practically we won't see a decrease in the ejection fraction, the amount that's ejected, the result caused by that slight delay in that valve opening. But if, in fact, that gets very, very high, we will see a difference. We'll talk, don't worry about that right now. We'll talk about that later when we start putting the system together. Any other questions about this? There were a number of people who the other day when they were building their model, that, well, doesn't the resistance of this valve affect stroke volume? Because if that resistance is high, or if arterial pressure is high, it's going to take longer to build up the force to cause that valve to open. And if the contraction period is a function of the amount of calcium that's in there, the action potential, then if it takes longer to build up this force, there's going to be less time available for ejection. And so the stroke volume will go down. That makes very good sense. But in the real world, the rate of rise of this pressure is so fast that if this pressure, if the afterload is higher, and it has to generate 5, 10, 15, 20 millimeters of pressure more, the time that it takes to do that is very, very small compared to the overall availability of calcium contractions. And in fact, you would not see a decrease.
Yeah,
when we get very high, we will. We'll come back to that. Okay? Okay.
You write on that and go on there?
Yes.
Wow, look at you, Mr. High Tech.
I didn't buy it, I already had it.
So, I emailed Dr. Ferguson about question number one, the thalamonic pressure.
You
said 2 hours.
She does usually?
I think she does.
Right, so you probably checked it right before class.
Otherwise, you just ask him in class.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, like, good for him. He's doing pretty good if he'll email you back.
Emil.
Page F 36. It's a homework assignment, a problem set. There are a couple things you need to notice about this problem set. First of all, it says work this problem in your study group. That means do it with somebody else. Talk about it. And what this is a heart lung preparation. We have heart, lung. We have right atrium, here's the vena cava. So the vena cava is connected to a reservoir, human blood. The ventricle is connected to the aorta, which pumps out into the ear and pushes back into the reservoir. There's a manometer connected to the atrium that allows us to measure the right atrial pressure. There's a manometer connected to the aorta, to the arterial line, that allows us to measure arterial pressure. There's a elastic reservoir here, an elastic buffer right here, so that blood can come in here and back out. That's all related to compliance of the system. There's an arterial resistance that we can change. And this heart is being stimulated to beat at a particular rate. And we're also able to measure the flow through the arterial system. I can raise this up or lower that down. And if I raise this reservoir down, what's going to happen to my atrial pressure? Then what? If I lower this reservoir down here, what's going to happen to right atrial pressure? It's going to go down. If it goes down, what's going to happen to ventricular filling? It's going to decrease. And if it decreases, what's going to happen to stroke volume?
Decrease.
And we'll go through there, and it'll ask, is there a set of questions that it's going to ask you about to figure out what's going on there? You're in the steady state, and the amount of blood is pumped from the left heart is equal to the amount that's pumped from the right heart. And stuff like that. And where would I find answers to this?
In the next solution?
In the end of the learning guide, that little packet that says homework answers. What's the gradient that's causing it? And why isn't the pump the gradient for causing flow from here to here?
Because
the driving force for moving blood from here to here?
Resistance.
That is what? Well, there's a gradient, but why is the pump the gradient?
Because it's not there.
It's creating the gradient.
Do you have an answer for me?
It's moving in opposite direction. Because it's not there.
What do you mean it's not there?
Because the pump is above it, it's not in the other rest
of it. Not in the path! This is not the gradient because the path goes from here around here to there. What's the gradient causing flow from here to here? Where would I measure, how would I determine the pressure gradient causing flow from here to here?
Measuring at point B.
Pressure, right, what do you mean? Pressure, what label? Pressure at, pressure at A. I measure the pressure at A.
Compare it to that at B.
And compare that to B.
D.
D is in dog.
Well, it'll move from A to B because B is less than A.
Yeah.
C is less than B.
Yeah.
D is less than C.
Yeah.
So, that's
so if I want to know what the gradient is across the whole system, where would I measure? What would I subtract?
A
alpha
minus
D. Dog.
Alpha minus dog. Okay, I think.
Yeah.
A and I subtract D. That's the path. So if we do that, we see that here's the driving force, 100 minus close to zero. What does that figure tell us about something going on around here? What? Pressure drops off dramatically. And why do you think the pressure might drop off dramatically at that point?
Because the tube is just down so
the surface area increases.
Well, the surface area, I don't see the surface area increasing.
Volume.
Does the resistance decrease? So where does this pressure fall? From B, because there's a big drop between B and C. What do you think happens between B and C? Does the hole get bigger?
Yes.
What is between B and C?
A
sphincter. What kind of sphincter?
A high resistance.
A high resistance stenosis. A high resistance sphincter. If I was listening to this at here, and here, and here, I'd hear a whole lot of noise there. What does that big pressure drop represent when you see that resistance? There's a whole big resistance there. Why is the pressure here less than the pressure there? What's happened there? As this blood has gone through that resistance, what's happened? Why does resistance decrease pressure? So why does it decrease the pressure? What happens at that point? Why does the pressure drop?
In any liquid that's moving through a channel, it's going to move faster through the middle than on the sides.
Why does the pressure drop?
Yep. Okay. It's going to move faster through the center than through the sides, like if you go on a creek bed or something like that. So when the channel gets bigger, there's more room for it to move faster through the middle than there is in a smaller tube.
Okay.
That's all I got.
So?
Volume increase?
Volume resistance.
Volume to that little tiny hole, and so when it opens back up, you don't have as much fluid there, as much volume to create that pressure.
Yeah, you have volume. What's happened?
It's soft.
There's less resistance on the other side.
Well, but so what does that resistance do that cause the pressure to causes this volume here to not have as much pressure. Where does that pressure go?
It goes against the walls.
It goes against the walls of the tube. And what does it do?
Expands the tube.
dV equals nRT.
It goes in all sorts of directions other than forward because it bounces off and goes the other way.
See, what happens when it bounces?
It slows down.
It loses energy. Number of molecules, same volume going through there, the volume molecules lose energy. When you take a bunch of molecules and you put them through a narrower space, they bump into the walls, they bump into each other, and when they bump into each other, they bump into the walls, they lose energy. What do I feel in that place?
Chaos.
I don't feel chaos. What do I feel if I'm standing in the middle of that stream? What might I feel?
Danger.
Heat.
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 Yeah.
I feel heat. Alright. Now, how can that, if I look at this model then, what does that model tell me about the relative ability of this compartment or that compartment to hold volume? Pardon? CD is larger, wider. It has high compliance because it's high compliance. But what else does it have? How else can you tell that? How can you tell if that compliance is high? Well, it's wider. Because the what'd you say?
The pressure's low.
So I have more volume for less pressure tells me that these are compliant walls. Here I have less volume because it's narrower. I have higher pressure. Those walls are less compliant. So in our model that we talked about, Seymour Fish, there's a pump. We have a pump. Here's the pressure reservoir. Pressure reservoir. We don't have an exchanger in this one, but then here we have the volume. So we're going to again look at that a little bit more. And we want to start by looking at the arterial compartment. So here we are. Now we're looking at the picture of 41. And there's an exercise there. And what I want to do first, oh, we have to talk about systole and diastole. Oh, geez, systole and diastole. All right. Systole and diastole. What does systole mean?
When the ventricles contract.
When the ventricles contract. What does diastole mean?
Ventricles relax.
The ventricles relax. And if we're talking about the ventricle, that's the definition of systole and diastole. And so if I look at this volume right here, that volume is N diastolic volume. That's the volume that's in the ventricle at the end of diastole, just before systole. And if I look at the volume here, what would you call that volume? If this is end diastolic volume, what's this volume? End systolic volume. Why would you call it that? That's the volume in the ventricle at the end of systole. How do I know it's the end of systole? The pressure is decreasing. And what would you call the difference between the end diastolic volume and end systolic volume?
Where exactly is the end systolic volume?
End systolic volume, let's say, is right here. What did you say it was?
Just there, that little spot.
Stroke volume.
Just that little spot that you put into the end?
The difference between what was in there and what was left in there is what went out. That's the stroke volume. Well, the reason I'm really not pointing to different places, this is all the same volume. Okay? So really what I tried to do first is point to this volume right here. Okay? But then we got into the isovolumic relaxation period and the volume is the same. Alright? Just a little terminology. This is the end of systole at the end of the QRS. No, that's the beginning. So the end of systole, you see, is just after repolarization. So contraction starts in here, right? Contraction starts in here when the calcium starts to come in. And calcium really leaves itself. So if I look at... this is contraction. And if we drove contraction, remember that contraction started here where the calcium came in, kind of went over here. It's a little bit after.
Thank you.
said, what we're talking about now is not physiology. What we're talking about is terminology. Okay? And what we said was, the word systole means contraction. And generally, the word systole means ventricular contraction. The word diastole means ventricular relaxation. But then we read our magic book, whatever it is, and our magic book says, when we talk about arterial pressure, we put the high pressure on the top of the numerator and the numerator, even on the top of the fraction, even though it's not really the numerator, and we put the low pressure on the bottom of the fraction. But we'll call the top one, the highest one, the systolic pressure, and we'll call the lowest one the diastolic pressure. The end, usually if we're talking about end systolic and diastolic, we're talking about ventricular things and not arterial things. Okay. So if we talk about end diastolic volume and end systolic volume, we're talking about volume of the ventricle. When we talk about arterial pressure, we say systolic arterial pressure, diastolic arterial pressure. And in those cases, systole and diastole don't have really anything to do with the ventricle. All they have to do is with a high number and a low number.
So why did they make it that way?
God knows. I don't know. God doesn't even know. Some cardiologists did that.
Just to confuse you all.
Just to confuse you all.
Okay.
It's one of those things that you find that for many, 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 many years there have been new things adopted. And the sole purpose is when the field felt as if the students were catching up, then they figured we need to add something new to reintroduce the field. Because otherwise, nobody will ask his questions and we'll be out of the field. Okay? So what we're talking about here is terms. And the important thing to remember is when I'm in the artery, I can't see what's going on in the ventricle unless the valve is open. And so if the valve is closed, I don't know what the hell the ventricle is doing. Okay. So having said that, let's focus on this pressure a little bit. And let's look at this model. And now you want to play your game again. What you want to do is stand in the artery, and what we have is a representation of an artery when the heart is in systole and when the heart is in diastole. And now you're just standing in the artery. And what I want you to do, this shouldn't be too difficult. But what I want you to do is based on your standing in there, and looking to the left and saying what's happening, and looking to the right and saying what's happening during systole, and looking to the left during diastole, ventricular diastole, and looking to the right during ventricular diastole. Think about what's happening to pressure in here and plot that pressure on the axis. I'll give you a couple minutes to do that.
Okay. Do this.
When the heart is moving
to
the
maintained by a
certain amount.
So this is pencil.
This is where.
So, light one at the end of diastolic, the beginning of systolic. So it decreases. Why does it decrease first?
Yes.
Because when the ventricle is active, the blood is higher. The I guess it has to stay up because I'm waiting. Look.
I can.
I can.
Prop.
And then go to the artery. Oh, there you are. That's why it's going down. It's increasing. And then it goes down. And then you have increasing.
Have
you ever done a picture of a
ventricle
brush on
and just get a nice gradient?
Because it
helps out.
This is in the ventricle. Make it a little higher.
That kind
of green the ventricle. So this is how it looks.
What you guys got?
So it turns diastolic into CPC. I don't think it becomes very much because that's just my
question.
Just do this thing? I mean, it depends on what your pressure guideline is, right? Yeah, I can see this by the way. Yeah, you don't have to drop down to zero.
I thought maybe diastole so it takes longer for it to go, so maybe it's gradual, slow. Whereas this one, because it's
diastolic,
maybe this is a quicker.
Is this part?
How did you run this?
Right, the increase. Diastolic.
I'm assuming that it's going to be kind of like a sine curve.
The solid then it actually would be higher pressure. So the first question is, if resistance increased, then there would be more pressure, right?
So
if it doesn't leave as fast, wouldn't it like make things go down in the vents?
Over time.
It's taking longer to make it go down. But this is so like if their viewpoint is an artery, right? So if you increase resistance, you have less blood going. But with higher pressure. And it's not going to leak as fast as the pressure whenever it gets elevated over a space.
So part of that like this?
I'm done. My brain is done right now. Maybe I'll go put that
here. Oh, wait, that's probably
yeah.
No, no, no.
Next question we want to ask ourselves, perhaps, or two questions later, is what is it? What is it that's going to affect the amount of blood going down? Okay, and so now we go to the bottom one. And we look to the left, and what do we see?
Nothing.
We see a wall, okay? We look to the right, what do we see?
Blood going away
from us. And so what is the pressure where we're standing compared to the pressure down here?
More.
Higher.
It has to be higher. It's a gradient.
What's causing that pressure here to be higher than down there?
The recoil
of the walls, okay. And so what's happening to the pressure around us?
Down.
It's what? It's decreasing.
If it costs really fast, it's going to increase, I guess.
So if we plot that, what do we see? Do we see the pressure doing? What is it doing first? We're standing here, what's it doing first?
Decreasing.
And then what is it doing?
Decreasing.
All right, is that what you got?
Yeah.
A little bit.
What did you get? Unlike this picture, you think that the time that it takes for blood to go off the periphery
is longer. Yep. Resistance
is here is longer than the time that it took to build the pressure. Correct?
Yes.
Bigger arrow coming in to what's going on. Okay, that's a reasonable thing. Now let's go back and look for a moment. At what happened in our area. What do they call
it? So it's the blood.
It's just trying to be contrary. Yep.
No. From my logic, if the blood was leaving slower than the blood that's that was coming in, then you would constantly be increasing the blood volume in that and where with each successive contraction. So you would constantly be increasing the pressure.
That would be valid if you weren't in a steady state. That would be valid if in fact the time for sustained diastole. Right? So what he said was, if in this picture, if these were equal times, and this flow out was less than the flow in up here, then at the next beat, there'd be more left in here, and we'd end up with a progressively higher pressure in the artery. So let's look instead, and that's valid, but let's look instead at the way this our cardiac cycle works.
Pressure fill.
She said that in systole there's more coming in than's going out, and so there's a volume buildup here and pressure is building. In diastole, there's no volume coming in, but there's volume going out, so the volume in here decreases and the pressure decreases.
And that is what is contraction because of the greater to lesser.
I didn't understand what. So the artery doesn't contract. Contraction to me means a muscle action. And so the artery was not really contracting. What the artery is doing is recoiling. In this situation, the increase in volume pushes those walls out. And when there's no more coming in, those walls recoil and provide the pressure for flow to go from here to here. Okay? Let's look at the timing of this. What Kelly was kind of alluding to is if I look at the ejection time during a normal cardiac cycle is only about a third of the whole cycle. So it looks like the ejection time is one third and the filling time is two thirds.
You've maxed out your stretch on batteries, or do you not reach that much pressure?
In this model, if the pressures we're looking at, you don't reach that. Can that be reached? Yes.
And so would you at least indicate you would expect to spike the pressure at that point? Yes.
I know it's going outside with the packet has, but I recognize that my pulse is not a steady tempo. Mm-hmm. That's the other piece of evidence that I was drawing on. My pulse is not done. That would give you that symmetrical arc if it was the same amount of time in and out, but we had
right.
One short first.
Right. So that's what we just said. What we just said was that systole is about a third of the cycle, and it's about two-thirds of the cycle. So now we want to say, okay, if that's the case, how would we change our diagram? Then we'll take a break. So how do we change that?
Just your muscle inside?
Okay. He says a steeper slope up and a more gradual slope. Here we go. We may have a steeper slope up. A more gradual slope down. And then we get the next beat. We have a steeper slope up. Down we continue. Okay? So now we said, all right, here's the blue one. That's more real. So after the break, now what we want to do is take that more real kind of thing and see what happens if we change a couple other factors that affect flow in and out. Let's take a break.
Okay.
Are you going to try to push it out? Yeah. I'm not going to try.
Right atrial pressure increases, but heart rate decreases. And then we can say, oh, you know what? It depends. It depends on how much right atrial pressure increases and how much heart rate decreases. The more times you know, the answer is by taking one thing at a time, you can see what the relative importance of that one thing is, and then put it into a broader perspective later on. And we'll do that, actually, when we start talking about these things. Say which is the bigger effect and which is not the bigger effect.
The arteriolar resistance is increased, and the pressure is increased, and then increased again with the next beat.
You go back to a steady state because at some point, now what do we mean by back to a steady state?
Just not increasing anymore, right?
Yeah. What we mean by back to a steady state is not back to the state we started at. It's back to a situation where the amount of blood coming in here in a period of time equal the amount going out. So what would happen? Well, this pressure would increase. The volume would increase. The volume of the system the next time we had systole would increase. And the pressure would increase a little bit, but when the pressure increased, the flow out would increase. It's not as big a gradient. And that would continue until actually the pressure increase in here was enough so that the flow out the period of time equal the flow in. Stream could change, what else could change? The compliance of the vessel could change. So now, draw what you think might happen if the compliance of the artery decreased. If it decreased.
Are we going back to just the control?
Compare with the control, right. Then go back and compare to the control again.
Okay, I'm doing your group ghost. That would mean that this wouldn't happen.
So, like, if there's.
So, the amount going in would be the same as the amount going
artery,
in.
Yeah, this one.
Right?
The amount coming in
would equal the amount going out.
Assuming there's no resistance here.
Well, we are assuming that. Because you said take it one thing at a time.
Okay.
So, wouldn't it, if we're looking at this picture, wouldn't, if these arrows are gone, right, completely, then this arrow would equal that arrow.
Wait, Tama, are you grouping arterioles and arteries together now?
I'm looking at the arteries.
Just arteries, not arteries.
And if this compliance is gone, then the amount going into the artery would be the amount going out. So then you wouldn't have a slower diastolic. Because that's what makes the diastolic take more time. Yeah. Would it go as high? Because this makes the pressure increase, right?
Uh-huh.
So wouldn't it just
increase pressure faster? The pressure wouldn't get as high?
I don't think the pressure would get as high, and I think that systolic and diastolic would be the same. You wouldn't have like a faster slope on one than the other.
Right. It'd be more, it would be closer to get.
Instead of systolic being one third and diastolic being two thirds, it would be 50-50. But yeah, I don't know if that makes sense. But.
Well, wouldn't that still take that long to leave because of the resistance here?
It would be less because you don't have this much of a difference. You have this much of a difference.
You're just saying it starts off at a lower point.
Yeah.
It seemed like it would still, like, your heartbeat would still be the same pattern. It would just, like, you only have to change this amount of pressure. So you have a long time to change that amount of pressure. You know what I'm saying? Like, it only has to change a certain amount of pressure, but fast and like the timing would still be the same, it would just take it longer. Yeah. Yeah. The difference in pressure is closer.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, because you'd never make, you would never get this high of a pressure, so that would be low. And then there wouldn't be such a difference, so this time would be less.
I'm not sure about that.
I don't know. I would think that...
because there's less volume. The pressure is the same or the greater or what?
The pressure would be less. It would just stay at the top. It would be like a plateau. I don't know.
Seems to me though it would generate pressure. If it was less compliant, it would just it would spend less time doing this and more time generating pressure. Right.
But the pressure that's generated by this action is the recoil. So if you never had that, you would never get that pressure of the recoil. Right?
Isn't compliance ability to move?
Yeah.
So basically, now it becomes like a steel wall.
Yeah.
It's all pressure.
Sure. Let's think of it that way.
The pressure just shoots up.
It's going to be higher pressure, but it's just going to be a constant. It's going to be the same all the way through.
I would think pressure would just build huge right here.
I guess I could see that. Yeah. Yes. It's so flippant.
But then,
frustrating.
I think it's higher pressure here, so it actually would take longer to get the volume.
Yeah, it would take longer.
Well, it's, I don't know, it's too bad. So, if the pressure is bigger,
this arrow would increase.
So it would actually be faster. Right, because your resistance increases, your volume goes down, and your pressure
goes up. Maybe like an
But you would agree.
Confused herself. I know that this arrow would be bigger.
But the very first part of her thing, it goes up, way shoots up really quickly.
Okay.
So all it can do is generate pressure. Yeah. Do we agree in that part?
Yeah. So it will be a pressure.
Agree here. Shoots up to pressure, and then now when it hits here, you have a huge amount of pressure. And it would just be the same resistance as it was before.
No, it would stay, and then it would drop.
Why would it stay?
Because when... So, blood's coming out of the ventricle, it's going in. And you reach a steady state, and blood's still coming in because this didn't move.
Oh, come in then. If it's coming in, pressure's building. Period. There's nowhere for it to go. Pressure has to go. There could be a point when it's no longer coming in, and then that pressure would stay.
When the volume comes in.
Let's see what they say. I don't know if the curve.
I know.
When the pressure increased
and
the volume came in.
Shall
be higher than how it's going to compare to control. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Took us 3 minutes to get to there.
Increase faster, okay, whatever it is. See a difference? What's going to happen? What's going to happen very diastole?
It's going to decrease really fast.
It's going to decrease really fast, okay.
But why? Because
resistance is the same pressure size.
Let's say it goes to the same point. It's going to decrease really fast. Actually,
it's fast, but let's use different colors.
Yeah.
Oh, we can't. So we can see black.
Okay, it's getting out of
hand. No black on here.
Oh, is it blue? Is it blue?
Yeah, it's blue and red.
Here, look at the screen and tell us what colors they are.
Blue, red, and
see this one here?
Light blue.
This one is decreased compliance color. It's a control color, and then it's increased resistance color.
Okay.
Perfect.
I know what you can tell them for.
Well.
So I have a question about compliance.
Change your mental model.
If you have decreased compliance, does that also mean you have decreased recoil?
No. What does it mean? If you have decreased compliance, what does that mean in terms of recoil? You have increased recoil.
Stainless steel wires.
It's like the old rubber bands.
But that would be resistance, right?
Are you doing microtubules and stuff?
So what's the difference between resistance and compliance?
What's the difference between resistance and compliance? Resistance, I think of as in a tube. It relates to flow. Compliance is a measure of recoil and relates to a wall. So you might say, you probably would say, that if I take two rubber bands, then pulling them is more resistant to stretch than one rubber band. But you see, I find that very confusing. The reason I find it very confusing is then when I talk about resistance, I don't know if I'm talking about stretch or flow. So I reserve the word resistance in my mind only to refer to flow.
So resistance.
And if I have an increased resistance, I have a decreased flow if pressure gradient doesn't change. And so now I think about recoil and compliance together. So if I pull one rubber band, it's more compliant than it is if I pull two rubber bands. And the reason that it's more compliant is because it has less recoil. If I make it stiffer, it has more recoil and it's less compliant. Okay. Why does this fall quicker?
More pressure, same resistance. Less volume, more pressure, same resistance.
He says the same resistance, less volume, but more pressure. Well, how can you have less volume and more pressure?
Because it's changed.
Because what's changed?
Less compliance.
The compliance.
Because there's more recoil. So for the same volume, you have a greater pressure. There's more recoil. Okay? Good. All right. Now tell me, how you would define, in this case, how would you define the pulse pressure?
I think you could have an area.
How
it goes down
define,
so fast.
If I say the pulse pressure
same
is
pressure, would be on the bottom.
Okay.
It goes up real quick, down real quick.
So where would you locate? How would you tell me
I found
it? If I decided that the pulse pressure was 60 millimeters, what would I measure and what would I do to calculate the pulse pressure?
That would be the pressure that's the happens at the systole, where it's entering. That would be the pulse point to the heart. That's what I was thinking.
Okay, so
that's systolic.
Let's draw a there's time, and here's pressure, okay, and now I'm going to draw several heartbeats, and then tell me what you're, where are you going?
I'm talking about from the moment the heart begins contracting, where it's, so at the very bottom of the curve.
And the heart begins contracting over here someplace in time.
Yeah. All the way until it finishes its contraction, which is right at the peak.
Is that the peak?
I understand what you said. Let's go back to this figure. Now, I think what you told me is that the pulse pressure would be, you said, from the beginning of the contraction, that's right here, to the peak of the contraction right there. How many people agree? Well, he said the pulse would be from the beginning of the contraction to the end of the contraction. How many people agree? Oh, wait a minute. Sure, Megan is kind of measuring the pulse here. She put her hand on her pulse.
Oh, yeah.
So, what is she measuring on this picture?
The time.
Is she measuring the beginning of the contraction? What do I feel? Where am I standing? If I hold my pulse here and I feel my pulse, where am I standing?
You're in the
ventricle. Am I in the ventricle? No, where am I? I'm in the artery. So, does the pulse go from here to here, or does the pulse go from here to here?
The second one.
It goes from here to here.
That's
the contraction. It doesn't go from here to here.
Well, the contraction goes from the red ball.
So the pulse pressure is the change in the arterial pressure that I measure by feeling the pulse. And so when I feel that pulse come toward me, I'm feeling this pressure. And when I'm feeling the pulse go away from me, I'm feeling that pressure. So that's the pulse pressure. How would you propose that I might calculate the mean arterial pressure? What does it mean to take the mean arterial pressure? I take a lot of them and average them together. Okay? So I wouldn't just take... In your absence, say, I just wouldn't take this number, subtract that number, divide by two.
Then you just take one. That's not very accurate.
So what is, in talking about the mean pressure, what does that act, what is, well, what information does the mean pressure tell you about? What is that? Is it the middle?
Pressure.
Is it the average? Okay, the average pressure over what? Not in a fraction, but average pressure measured over time. Okay. So, if I look at this pressure over time, you think the mean pressure is closer to the systolic or diastolic pressure?
Diastolic.
Is it dead set in the middle or is it closer to one or the other?
Mean over time would be more towards the diastolic. More towards the diastolic?
More towards the diastolic. And why?
It spends more time.
Because it spends a longer time in the diastolic phase. And again, we're talking about diastolic and systolic. Not having to do with the ventricle, really, but having to do with the pressure. So a rule of thumb... A rule of thumb is that the mean pressure we can guesstimate as about a third of the way between the diastolic pressure and the systolic pressure. So if I take this difference between the systolic pressure and diastolic pressure, divide by 3 and add it to the diastolic pressure, I'll end up with something close to the mean. But what's important to realize, important to remember is that the mean arterial pressure is not the middle. It's the mean over time. It's the average over time. It's to be closer to the diastolic pressure. All right. Now, what you saw here, when you really thought about it a moment, is that the analysis that you went through by standing in that artery, And by deciding what happened if you change resistance, you change compliance. It's not a simple analysis. It's a rather complicated analysis. But most of you had very little problem doing it. You're trying to figure out what happened when they sensed. And what was the key to that? What is it that helped you make sense of what was happening if the resistance downstream increased or if the compliance decreased?
Past experience.
Was it past experience?
It helped me to imagine I was in the dot.
Pardon me?
Standing in the dot.
Standing in the dot. Standing in the system lets you focus on what it is that you're talking about and lets you imagine what's happening around you. Now, having said that, can you get any information? Do you think you can get any information from the pulse pressure, from the difference between here and here? Let's say that there's a big pulse pressure. Let's say that the difference between top pressure and bottom pressure is fairly large. What might you guess is going on there?
More resistance or less compliance.
The question that I asked was, if I have a big pulse pressure, what do you think could explain that? And what you said was that I would have either a low compliance, or you said I could have a high resistance. But would I get a big pulse pressure if I had a high resistance?
Our diagram here, we said that
the diastolic pressure would increase, so the pulse pressure might actually decrease, depending, of course, on how much this peak is.
Okay, so we have a
so now let's go a step further. Let's go a step further and say that we have a small pulse pressure. Did I say small or big?
Big.
We have a big pulse pressure and a low mean pressure.
And then
big pulse pressure and a low mean pressure. Do you think the problem is decreased compliance or some resistance problem? Decreased compliance? Why do you think the decreased compliance?
Because your mean is lower, which means that
I would actually put off until your systolic
and less pressure is a greater amount of time. So,
fillings.
And then this one is systolic.
Okay. So he says, well, okay, if there's decreased compliance, it's going to really go up fast and really go down low. So over time, because there's more time spent in diastole, more time spent draining out before there's another contraction, you expect that average will be low. Maybe half, maybe half. I guess the point of talking about it is not what's the right answer, what's the wrong answer. By thinking about the pulse shape, the mean, pressure, and systolic diastole, now you can think about different aspects of that system that may be affecting things. So we will end up looking at a couple of patients where, in fact, that might give us some clue. Looking at the pulse pressure might give us some clue as to what's going on.
And then at those points, at the end of each one is where you actually get the pressure.
We've already talked about.
So these are where you get what?
Yeah, that's right. Systolic. That's your diastolic. It's at the end of each process.
Oh, so end
diastolic. Yeah.
Okay. I have like 500 in my room.
Or we will look at patients with exercise 4 and 5. So this is starting to put stuff together. We'll collect cards. Don't forget your name tag. You can put the table and chairs back together.
Exercise before and back in the days. Oh. Tomorrow.
It is the 18th.
Want to go over his answers?
Yeah.
At least if we can use the other side of our previous quizzes, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so I got. I put 8.
Yeah, oh, for 1?
Yeah.
Yeah, it has to do with osmotic pressure being a negative pressure of sucking water into the veins. So if you look in how osmotic pressure is defined in the physiology coloring book, for example, it tells you that. I thought so. I put 8 first, too.
Are you sure it's B?
Yeah, because it's really, the osmotic pressure is like, it's an actual negative pressure.
But yeah, but it's
you're sucking it in
from the arterial end because of the HEVs. I was like reading.
Right. So now you're looking at the difference between interstitial fluid and the blood in the venous system, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So you're looking at it. Basically, the high pressure is high pressure of blood or water in the tissue space, but it's not osmotic pressure. Osmotic pressure is actually when you have the higher proteins in the veins. So it's actually a negative pressure. The water wants to go across the membrane to fill up that. And that's what osmotic pressure is.
It's just negative blood.
Because it has a lot more dissolved protein stuff in it. So the interstitial fluid has lots of fluids, but not a lot of protein. So it's the ratio of protein to fluid. But it's weird because it's high and negative.
Yeah, but
because it's hydrostatic for the arterial and it's osmotic for the venous.
Yeah, but of tissue space, not of blood.
That's what I thought at first too, but that's what it is. I don't hail
okay, hold on.
Let me see if I got my coloring book.
B2 is E, yeah. You know, are you sure it's not
yeah, that
B?
Yeah, that's smarter.
yeah, that's where the B cells are made, but not where antibodies are made.
But it says production of most of our antibodies.
Oh. Right, and so E is
all
right, where
so
most of our
antibodies are made. Some other people got E too.
B is E.